Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's not often that members of the U.S. Congress get the opportunity to weigh in on international trade. Negotiations over fast-track authority for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, in recent months have come the closest to enabling elected representatives a chance to voice their opinions on how the U.S. government should engage with other countries financially. For decades now, we've heard the claim that free trade is equivalent to freedom in general, that if corporations were simply allowed to freely do business around the world without having to contend with tariffs, regulations, and other so-called trade barriers, that it would naturally result in an equal playing field. But in fact, the rich have gotten richer, the poor poorer, and the planet thrown into peril. And while international trade does not manifest in lethal bombs, its impact on communities is similar to that of war, so writes my guest Yash Thandan, who has had decades of on-the-ground experience as a high-level negotiator in bodies such as the World Trade Organization. He's also the author of the new book Trade is War, The West's War Against the World, and he now joins us on a video stream. Welcome to, we're trying to get him on. He's going to join us live from London, so do bear with us. And I think we do have him now. Welcome to Uprising, Yash. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, you are from Uganda, and much of your experience with the impact of trade policies is on the African continent. I want to begin by asking you how the history of colonialism links to the West's trade policies, essentially what the links are between the past and the present with colonialism and trade.
Well, actually, it goes back before colonialism. It goes back to the slave trade. The trade began with human beings trafficking across the oceans as a matter of trade. The first time you had human beings traded, you had slavery in the past, the ancient past, but slave trade began with the beginning of European civilization. And then came the colonial period. Of course, as you know, in 1884 at Berlin, Africa was put on the map and just divided up, and then followed brutal trade war against Africa, which virtually killed off existing agriculture, economy, and so on, and imposed on that a colonial economy. And following from that, we had independence, so to speak, but really only political independence. We never in Africa managed to get a control over our economy. So we still are in a period of war with the West, where trade has more or less devastated our economies, creating millions of people out of job, destroying our agriculture and industry, and the corporations, global corporations, have simply been appropriating our resources and impoverishing our people.
Now, so that's war. Set the stage for our audience about the role that you have played and the sort of firsthand experience that you have had in the sort of international trade arena. You have actually been a high-level negotiator at a World Trade Organization ministerials for years. So you've directly seen how these negotiations happen in these boardrooms in places like Geneva that are completely cut off from what's happening on the ground?
Absolutely. Because the World Trade Organization is a secretive organization. It's a conspiratorial body. I have experience in official delegations of African countries sitting in negotiation process. And we have been cut out from negotiations. They have something called green rooms. These are rooms to which the big powers are engaged in negotiations, Europe, United States, Japan, and they call a few countries like India, Brazil, China. And occasionally an African country gets into that, invited by them. But the negotiations are between the great powers. And once they have negotiated, that's it. The last day, I've seen it many times, on the last day of the meeting, of the conference, the speaker simply reads out a statement presumably agreed to by consensus between the parties, and simply banks on the table and says, agreed, and nobody objects, agreed, immediately. There is no discussion, nothing. This is a This is a green room process, and the process is totally flawed and conspiratorial.
What is the ideology that they spout to justify the dominance of so-called free trade as a pathway to development and freedom? Because we often hear a utopia being painted in our future if only countries dropped tariffs and regulations that protect workers and the environment. But that doesn't often play out. So what do they, how do they sell it?
Well, it's an ideology. That's true. I can say with some authority, because I'm an economic historian and I've taught for nearly over 40 years, I can say with some knowledge, there has never, ever been free trade. Hmm. Never. The golden period, so-called the golden period of English mercantile system in the 19th century, was never free trade. Never. So it's a myth that's created. And you know what? It's a myth perpetrated by universities across the world.
And when you say there has never been free trade, you're saying that the trade has never truly been free, that it's never truly been free of all sort of interference, because it tends to be propped in favor of corporations rather than the other way around.
Well, corporations came later, that's it. Corporations are a more modern phenomenon. But I'm even talking about the mercantile period, mm-hmm. British-English mercantile period, when it was basically trading companies, at that time colonial trading companies, like East African, right. Like East India Company, and so on. And at that time, too, trade was never free. And that's why the first opposition to so-called free trade came from the United States. It's the U.S. that said, no, this is not free trade. This is colonial trade, where we Americans manufacture cotton and tobacco, and you England manufacture end products. So basically, it has never been free trade.
And but so haven't many of these Western countries historically used protectionist policies to build their wealth in the first place, so that in this era of supposed free trade, they have all the advantage?
Absolutely. In fact, they hide behind the dogma or the ideology of free trade. In actual fact, they have always been protectionist, always. England was protectionist when it was industrializing. United States, Germany, Europe, Japan, Switzerland, all were protectionist. Hmm. And then at that time, by the way, if I may add one more thing, the intellectual property, which talks about patenting of knowledge, that in previous eras were always free. Knowledge is always free. But with the coming of capitalism, they have commoditized knowledge. So even knowledge is no longer free. There's nothing free or fair in the capitalist system. Every aspect of trade and intellectual knowledge is war.
Now, your book focuses on the global south and largely Africa, but the issue of international trade has been coming up here in the United States, where our program is based, in the last few months in particular. And so I'd love for you to indulge us just briefly, at least, on some of the issues that are coming up here with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this supposed free trade agreement between a number of different countries. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is one of our few progressive senators here in the United States, just released a report entitled Broken Promises, Decades of Failure to Enforce Labor Standards in Free Trade Agreements. And our president is trying to sell us this idea that signing the TPP will result in better jobs for Americans, better protections for Americans. He even had a press conference at a Nike factory saying that Nike would add, you know, thousands of new jobs if the U.S. signs the TPP. But I'm guessing that you are much more in agreement with Senator Elizabeth Warren than with Barack Obama on this.
Oh, absolutely. I think she is on the right stand. It's a propaganda by the big corporations. I imagine some of the biggest global American corporations are funding Obama's election campaign. I would imagine. I think, and of course, the corporations have penetrated policy making structures within practically every state in the world. So it's not simply United States that is pushing for free trade, TTIP and TPP, and all these free trade global bilateral agreements. Even Europeans, even governments in the countries of the South are pushing for that, because globally, transnational corporations have taken over our economies, penetrated policy-making structures in our countries, and they are all in agreement. And against these are, of course, the people, because contrary to what they claim, they will create a massive, well, they can create jobs in America, but to those who produce high technology materials, high technology equipments, but it will create massive unemployment down the road. So we are entering into a period of what I call centralization of global capital. And that can only happen at the cost of people who will be thrown out of jobs and small-scale enterprises. That's the outcome of what they are proposing.
Now, let's talk about the fact that you are using very strong language to describe the impact of this these international trade policies. Your book is entitled Trade is War. And while many people have detailed the very devastating impact of trade on the ground, very few have, I think, likened it to war, because it's not necessarily directly tangible. You know, it's sort of a slow-moving disaster when trade policies that are skewed towards corporations hit poor countries. So explain why you use this title. Why is trade sort of essentially equivalent to a war on poor people?
Well, let me add a footnote here. And this is that trade does not have to be war all over time.
Sure.
Trade has taken place between India, China, Africa for thousands of years.
Humans have always traded.
And you produce things and you trade. So trade is necessary. I'm not against trade as such. What has happened is that over the last 500 years, and that's not long, five centuries, with the coming of emergence of capitalism as a global system, that's when trade became war. India traded with Africa, no war. England came to Africa and started colonizing Africa. India went to England for trade. And guess what? Colonized India. England wanted to trade with China, and China was happy to do that. Not necessarily, because China was quite self-sufficient. But England did not have silver to pay for trade with China. And guess what? Imposed opium trade. They got China to accept opium in exchange for trade. And there were opium wars. So you see, for the last 500 years, it has been unmitigated, relentless war. I'm not using strong words. I have experienced all this on the ground in Africa, relentless war. So what's the situation in Africa now? Millions of people are getting out of Africa, getting into boats in the Mediterranean, getting killed by the thousands in the Mediterranean because their continent has been impoverished by the so-called trade. Trade is war.
Let's talk about one specific aspect of how trade and international trade policies have very directly impacted ordinary people, and that is the treatment of food as a commodity. Now, how is it that food even became a commodity to be traded on the international market, and how do Western nations even justify it?
Well, as you know, food was never part of the global trading system. It is the United States that pushed agriculture to become part of the global system, the World Trade Organization. Europeans fought against it for quite some time, but in the post-Second World War period, United States was dominant, and the Europeans had no choice but to accept agriculture as part of global trade. Okay, so that's how agriculture became part of the global system. Again, defended by the same myth, namely that you free trade and there'll be prosperity for people and so on. This is utter contrary to all evidence on the ground. Let me give an example. We have four African countries in French Africa. that produced cotton and food for themselves. United States gives subsidy to cotton producers in America. The prices of cotton have fallen down. The result of that is that the peasants who are growing food and cotton in Francophone Africa have lost all their possibility of competing against subsidized cotton from America. They not only lose cotton, but they have also lost agricultural land from which they used to get food. Now, that's not just four cotton countries. All over Africa, we have not only lost control over our industries, but also our agriculture. So Africa has now become net food importing countries. Can you believe it?
Wow.
If you go to my country in Uganda, where I come from, you go to big shops, big stores, and you find, believe me, chicken legs from Belgium. Whereas in fact, we have free-ranging chicken all over the country.
Wow.
They can't compete against imported chicken, which are subsidized in Belgium. Can you believe that? This is disastrous. And the only thing that is keeping up is the whole myth created by not only corporations, but I have sad to say, by big universities like Harvard and all the economics departments in these universities are, in my view, peddlers of an ideology that makes no sense whatever on the ground.
Right.
Imagine that.
There was a recent ruling that affected the United States from the World Trade Organization. U.S. consumers wanting meat from other countries to be labeled by its point of origin, but Canada and other meat exporting countries and the corporations that work there said that the labeling disadvantages their meat. So the WTO has ruled in their favor. Just sort of another example of how the WTO and those sorts of international bodies are trumping over consumer concerns. And I shouldn't even use the word consumer, because that, of course, is also the language of international trade. Ordinary people who eat, perhaps, is the better way to put it. Finally, let's, in the last part of our conversation, Mr. Tandon, let's talk about the pushback, because there is pushback. And you started an organization called the Southern African Trade Information and Negotiations Institute. Why did you start it, and what sort of success has this group enjoyed, and has it been an example of the kind of pushback we've seen globally?
Well, Ciattini, that's what it's called, S-E-A-T-I-N-I, Ciattini. I created it after my experience at the first World Trade Organization in Singapore in 1997. It was astonishing. I got a shock of my life, because there were African negotiators from all over countries making speeches in the plenary session, and behind their backs, they were working out agreements on, at that time, on iPhone, on telecommunications. And Africans did not know about that. And the agreements, which are agreed by big powers in the WTO, are binding. If you don't abide by those agreements, there are sanctions. So WTO is a veritable war machine. I came home and I started asking ministers of African countries, and I was familiar with many heads of states in our countries, and I said, why did we sign this? They said, well, we are told that free trade will benefit you. You know, they never even read the Uruguay agreement. They signed the agreement.
Wow.
Then I decided, we need to create an institution that builds the capacity of African trade negotiators. And we've been working now for nearly 15 years now and battling out WTO. It's not as if WTO has all its way. We have succeeded in Cancun. We succeeded in Seattle to overthrow WTO. And we'll succeed again in Nairobi. You watch.
Now, you have, just pinpointed the fact that people do need to fight back. And in your book, you say that an asymmetric power situation demands guerrilla tactics. And you've even sort of brought up Che Guevara, saying we've got a lot to learn from Che. What do you mean by using guerrilla tactics to fight back against this, a nonviolent guerrilla war?
Well, you have to look at the terrain. The terrain right now is asymmetrical. We have not only the big powers behind so-called free trade corporations, but also our governments in our countries. Especially in Africa, they are aid dependent. They are dependent on all kinds of promises made by Western countries. Okay, that terrain is a difficult terrain. You don't just rush into that and start blowing hot and cold. You have to be very careful. So you tread softly. When the terrain is tough against you, you don't fight directly. But when you find weaknesses on the other side, then of course you can penetrate those areas, that terrain, and play up the differences amongst the big powers. That's what we did in Seattle. That's what we did in Cancun. We found in Cancun, for example, the Americans and the Europeans were fighting on agriculture issues. They had not agreed on those. They then started to impose a tax on us, on third world countries, and we mobilized the countries of the South to reject agriculture as proposed by the United States. And Cancun failed on agriculture. Similarly, Cancun failed on imposing on African countries so-called Singapore issues. It's technical, I won't go into that. And there again, we were able to play the differences that existed between developed countries themselves. I call that a kind of guerrilla warfare, non-violent. It's the WTO that is violent. It's big countries that are violent because they impose sanctions on us. We play tactical game. We watch the terrain. We see the balance of forces. We don't rush into it if you are not prepared. And we prepare our ground, we prepare our people, we prepare our negotiators. Lots of work beforehand. So that's what I call a guerrilla warfare.
What about the big developing countries, the so-called BRICS nations? That's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. How have they, in their own way, and of course with their own interests in mind, fought back against institutions like the WTO?
Well, it's a complex struggle. Yeah. You find that there are many issues, such as trade, for example, aspects of trade, intellectual property, climate change. There are a number of issues, human rights and so on, number of issues on which not just BRICS countries, but southern countries as a whole generally agree. Of course, there are differences amongst them, but they generally agree. So there is a veritable north-south divide. There's no question about that. But within the north, there are divisions. Within the south, there are divisions. Now, BRICS are large countries in the south. And for sure, China is profiting from liberalization of trade. They are not free traders as ideologists. Free trade was created by the Western countries. China was not even a member of the World Trade Organization when the bigger powers, Europe and America, obliged African countries to lower down their tariff barriers, to remove their protection. And guess what? It's China that is taking advantage of that.
Right.
China never asked us to lower down our barriers. America and Europe did. And now that China is taking advantage of that and bringing goods into our countries, which compete against American and European goods, they are screaming, China is now colonizing Africa. Nonsense. That's not the case. China may become an imperial country at one time. I don't know. I'm not saying that that potential does not exist. But as of now, China brings us a possible counter power to that which dominates us right now, America and Europe.
Well, finally, what about ordinary people who don't have access to the governments of BRICS nations or even big organizations or have connections to negotiators? How are ordinary people organizing, particularly in poor communities? How are they pushing back? Because they do have power, even if they don't have access to the green rooms of the WTO, for example.
Well, it's a power of resistance. I've used quite strong words in my book, and I would say strongly also that at this point in time, believe me, the survival of our people on the ground in Africa, that itself is act of resistance. I come from Uganda, and I have traveled around, and I have lived for over 20 years in Zimbabwe. I have traveled around, I have worked in rural areas for 17 years, and I find that our people are able to produce without technology from outside. They're able to cure people of illnesses by using their traditional knowledge. They are refusing to get into the market system, and they're organizing in a community sense. So there are thousands, excuse me, there are thousands of such efforts at the community level where people are able to exist in spite of the attempt on the part of global corporations to destroy their self-reliance. So yes, people can't resist.
How important, and finally, how important is it for ordinary Americans, we are the subjects of the biggest empire in the world today, and there was a recent Gallup poll in March that examined the support for international trade among Americans, and it actually found a lot of support. A majority of Americans supported the types of trade deals that we see playing out today and that you denounce in your books. Even Democrats found Democrats supported international trade policies as they exist today, and even higher numbers than Republicans, about 58% of Democrats. I'm sort of at a loss as to how to explain that. Perhaps it is because the realities of how these trade policies impact people aren't percolating directly to those who respond to such polls. But how important is it for Americans to really understand what you describe in your book?
Well, we are talking at two levels. We are talking at the party political level, and then we are talking at the level of the people. At the party political level, perhaps the Americans may not be able to see what we see from outside, because you live in American society, you see the difference between Republicans and the Democrats. We from Africa don't see any difference. What is the difference between the two parties? Tweedledee, Tweedledum. There's no choice between them. Exactly the same. The same corporations run both of them. They have slightly nuanced views on certain things, but they're exactly the same. They're both imperialist parties. No question about that. Now, that's at the level of your parties. You don't have a political party in America that speaks for the people. There isn't one. They have been tried. People like Ralph Nader, for example, have tried in the past, but they don't. They don't get votes enough to come to power.
Yeah.
So that's at the party level. At the people level, I have to say, I have traveled in America. I was in Columbia University in the 1960s. I was quite astonished that once you move away from the eastern coast and the western coast, the ignorance of among the people is incredible. This lack of knowledge, lack of understanding, astonishing. I find Europe much more enlightened. America is not. Can you imagine the biggest empire in the world, contemporary empire in the world, consisting of people who do not know the geography of the world? I'm sorry to say that. I'm not belittling the people. But I don't understand the kind of structures that you have, knowledge structures that you have in America, that you produce millions of people who are voting in political parties, totally ignorant of what's happening in their own countries, let alone the rest of the world. I'm sorry to say that, but this is reality on the ground.
That's the ignorance that programs like ours try to remedy with guests like yourself. I want to thank you so much, Yash Tandon, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
My guest, Yash Tandon, has written a book called Trade is War, the West's War Against the World. He's had years and decades, really, of on-the-ground experience as a high-level negotiator in such bodies as the World Trade Organization. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break.